Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to the Realignment Q&A discussion session. End of the year. Thanks for joining us. Hope people are going to have a great break. I know Sagar and I both will. Quick note, to listen to the full version of this episode, go to realignment.supercast.com or click on the link at the top of the show notes. Once again, realignment.supercast.com. Let's just kind of start in the free section. I was at an event and people asked, what is an optimistic note you're ending the year on? And Sagar, I'd be super curious what your answer to that question is.
Okay. The Federal Reserve announced 3 rate cuts. Equities markets are doing well. There's good evidence that home prices are relatively flat. So now is a great time to buy a house if anybody's in the market. I think that economically, things are looking a little bit better, and we should all be optimistic and happy about that.
Yeah, no, I think this is where I think the fact that you're nonpartisan in a very specific way is helpful, because on the one hand, there's this like certain parts of the aisle obviously want the picture to be really great and really rosy. Other parts of the aisle really want things to be really bad. I think this is the awkward dynamic around Trump and inflation, because if you're a Republican going into the next year, I'm not alleging anyone in the audience who's a Republican is like literally thinking this way, but definitely from a taking a step back perspective, like the best case scenario for Republicans is a scenario where people say to themselves, like, look, Trump, we don't like the Republican Party's position on abortion, but everyone knows Trump's in his own category when it comes to abortion politics. So he's probably pretty moderate. And you know what? This inflation dynamic, the economy's bad. I just want it to be January 28th, 2020 all over again. So the economic picture changing, if you're on the Biden side, if it actually continues, is an important dynamic there. But yeah, raise that.
So I think it's important to distinguish what I said. I said things are looking better. I didn't say things are good. And I didn't even say things are good or net to 2020. So this is, maybe we should just get into it now. There's the whole vibe session, real session debate.
That was number 4, but we're going to. Wait, Sagar, before you start, I want to say this real quick. So vibe session has blown the F up. And in that term blowing up, Kyla Scanlon has legitimately been erased from being the original. This is actually crazy. Kyla unironically invented the vibe session term. Everyone and their cousin is totally just
It'll be in the New York Times soon. So good for her.
Yeah, it'll be in the New York Times. She has her book coming out in April. So I just want to give a Kyla Scanlon call out.
Okay. Shout out to Kyla, former guest of the Realignment, if people want to go and listen to that episode. I split the difference. I think the vibes are bad, and I think the economy is bad. And I think that some of the vibe session stuff about people who are saying that it's just a bad vibe are being really dishonest. And I think this is where something Dave Ramsey says a lot is that personal finance is 80% personal. And I think that's a really important concept for the vibe session debate. So a lot of the debate that's currently happening online is whether the economy is better today net to last year. But Marshall, that's not how people experience prices. The way that we experience prices, and I actually pulled all the CPI data to bear this out. CPI data showed us that inflation 2015 to 2019 was like 6 or 7%, negligible, right? January 2019 to today is 23%. That's nuts. So in a very short period of time, the prices for everything went up. Now, in terms of real wages and all of that, there's still not, I think, a very compelling argument, but it is certainly true that people have gotten like some more money. More importantly to that is that people are not economic automatons. Like, we're not widgets who experience the economy that way. When I buy eggs, I think about the historical price of eggs from the day I was a child relative to now. Mm-hmm. And I think, especially as an adult, somebody who's millennial, you and me, we became like full-blown adults only 10 years ago. Well, within that time span, the vast majority of the inflation that you and I experienced in our life has happened in the last 4 years. So empirically for us, and most of that Joe Biden has been president, it's hard not to associate this time with a gut-wrenching feeling of the $150 you spend whenever you walk out of a grocery store, from sticker shock whenever you look at a house and you look at the proposed mortgage payment, especially considering the interest rate environment. So I stick up for the people who are on the other side of vibe session, because people just do not experience the economy on a day-to-day basis. You need a much longer time horizon. And actually, when I think when I put it that way, it's not that hard to understand a lot of the economic sentiment in the country.
Yeah, totally. Which is, on the one hand, there's a Federal Reserve driven analysis, and then there's just like the political economy analysis, which you just gave there.
Yeah.
And I think just the real interesting question here is, clearly things are moving in the right direction. The question I'm thinking about is, are they moving in the right direction at the right moment so that a year or a little less than a year from now, a Biden election will not be a referendum on the economy, will be a referendum on abortion, culture war, Trump. And my kind of guess here is that if Biden pulls this off next year, the takeaway we're going to have is, man, it just started to get better with enough of a 6 to 8 month lag time that you could see that in the election results. And also, if Biden loses, I clearly think people are going to say to themselves, yeah, it started getting better, needed to start getting better in June, July, August. And that three or four month gap is going to make a difference. I do want to talk about something real quick, because I thought this was the funniest and worst of all the Vibe Session debates. Did you see Sean Trende and his DoorDash situation?
I didn't see this. So what is it? Pretty out.
This is a fun one. So Sean Trende, Worker Politics, AI, pollster. He was very much on your side. Not your side, but the analysis you gave about, like, okay, you could talk to about all the data you want, but if we look at actual lived experiences, this is what's happening here. And he gave the example of, I went and ordered on DoorDash. I went to Outback Steakhouse, got a bunch of steaks, got two blooming onions, got a bunch of stuff.
Wow.
It was $125. And he's like, look at these things. But it ended up self-owning himself. Everyone's like, wait, dude, you cannot go on DoorDash and order Outback Steakhouse and not expect this to be a disastrous example. It's just it's a funny low stakes, like a counter example of the Dr. Oz thing we loved laughing about last year, where they found like the most like out of touch and unrealistic thing, where this is what's actually happening with the DoorDash stuff. And you and I have definitely experienced this, is DoorDash being so expensive is just like the age of cheap capital being over.
Yeah,
I was like, DoorDash should not be cheap. It should not be cheap to get DoorDash to drive a full $80 meal to your home on a Friday evening. And that's really where that's kind of happening. But I thought this was a funny example of it.
I have the food. There's like a subcategory of Vibe Session, which focuses on food delivery. And I'm like, guys, this has entirely more to do with high interest rates drying up venture capital than it has to do with anything inflation. It's like Uber. The reason Uber got more expensive is because they couldn't keep subsidizing the rides as much as they were previously. Yeah. So anyway, I think it all just comes back to, there's been a shit ton of inflation over the last 4 years. And I honestly don't think things will get better enough in time for Biden, because a net 15% inflation is so high. It's still double what people experienced previously. People are not forgiving in that, especially when you consider the housing market. I mean, I don't know. I'm not. The thing is, the Fed says they're going to cut rates 3 times. So I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, I don't think people jump back in the market till we see 4%, which is around where things were in like 2021. That's a long way on the tail end of a lot of those rate cuts. And we may not even get there. It could go to 5, something like that. Things are at 7 and 8 right now, which is crazy. But my point just being that the end entree points, and also you need a while to mellow in a 4% thing to be like, okay, now I'm considering buying a house again. So the lead time on some of this data just takes too long to materialize before November. We've only got 11 months to go. That's just not a long time.
Yeah, I think part of the issue, and this is where the 2022 midterms and the special elections start mattering, is it's not that. And actually, I think the Biden effort to turn Bidenomics into Reaganomics 2.0, right? And the thing is, I'm a Bidenomics supporter, but like, as someone who actually like talks with like serious Bidenomics people, the thing you understand about Bidenomics is it's really a long-term pitch.
Yeah.
Because the actual like serious Bidenomics pitch is, hey, neoliberalism wrecked this country. It made us not resilient. It made our supply chains weak. It made it so we didn't have manufacturing. 50 years from now, when we look at the American economy, how we're able to transition to something better, we're going to see that this big legislation that made these long-term investments made the difference. Here's, and I actually, I directionally believe in that statement. Here's the problem. That's not how elections work.
Yeah,
like you cannot say to people, vote for me because we've made investments in things that will pay off in 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 20, 50 years. So that was a weird example where, and I actually know a lot of the people in the Biden administration where this happened. I think you actually had a situation where intellectuals got too high on their own supply and were able to overwhelm instincts that any political prognosticator could have given of like, hey, this all sounds great, but you're confusing what you want the Oxford History of the America, of the United States written in 2070 to say with what any voter left to like right is actually going to kind of reflect
totally.
On.
Totally. Yeah,
so that's that was a total, because once again, like Bidenomics is not a response to inflation. Bidenomics is a response to foundational weaknesses in the American economy. But when have we ever voted on that dynamic? So that was just a, that was just a terrible, you just say it out loud. You're like, guys, like, come on. Like, this, you don't have to be a political professional to know that's an issue.
Well,
but I think what they're just
blame President Biden. I think that's where Biden, think, he's the one who calls it. Oh, he's the one who embraced it. He put it on White House events. That's his own goal.
And I think that's the weird. And I think the weird thing with Biden is he's both obviously like the buck stops here with everything Biden, so he's ultimately responsible. Just once again, like knowing the folks who did this, I definitely don't think this originated with Biden. I think this was
I don't think it originated with him. I just think he decided to embrace it, which is cool. He's the he's the president of the United States. He's the elected politician.
Yeah, and actually, this speaks to an election topic I want to kind of hit on. So, I'm gonna ask you a question about like general reading you've been doing, because people love like book suggestions. And the reading suggestion I'm going to offer up for folks, and this actually relates to the Biden administration problems, is just I've been just doing so much FDR, New Deal, arsenal of democracy era reading, obviously because of the day job. But the thing that really just like struck me is the more and more you read about FDR, especially towards the end, so 44 onwards, when he's just actually dying, when his shirt collar is hanging off and people see him in person, they're like, oh my God, this man like looks like death. He can't speak. He's drooling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, we had a different media environment then, but like this is still a serious dynamic for the presidency to really like occupy. And as I just see and read about this history, I know you've read about this history too, you just see like, wow, the FDR people elevated so many impressive and interesting people who just took up so much of the attention. And I think it's so funny that the Biden team and Biden himself, you know, took down the Andrew Jackson poster, not poster, the Andrew Jackson painting, yeah, which Trump and Steve Bannon put up and replaced with FDR. So the whole framework is, okay, like this is the next New Deal period. Okay, take that framing. But they didn't operationalize it, which is that FDR is literally enfeebled and hobbled. So he brings in all these other people who in many ways could assume the burden of the presidency, George Marshall, Henry Stimson, Harry Hopkins, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can do a whole history of the FDR era. And obviously you could talk about FDR and you should talk about FDR, but there are also just these gargantuan figures that filled that energy. And I think what Biden should have done is, I'm Bidenomics guy. I've got this long-term vision, but I also have these like people who are here, right now, who are bringing energy. Like, look at how excited people were when Mark Cuban left the Mavs. People are like, oh, I don't think he's going to run for president, but he's clearly going to do something. Look at how successful and interested people were in his cost plus drugs thing. Like, why wasn't there an effort to like, hey, like, let's get Mark Cuban involved somewhere here. Let's bring this person. Let's bring that person in. There's just like a real failure to kind of like think about how they could respond to the obvious deficit they were going to be in when it came to Biden's like literal performance of the presidency. That's just like a takeaway I had from reading about the FDR era. But I just suggest that folks like read about that period. It's just so interesting. There's so much to kind of go through there. But like, what's just something in general you've been like reading about that you think folks should check out during the break or afterwards?
Kessinger's death put me on a big Vietnam kick.
Hot.
So I finally read A Bright Shining Lie by Neil Sheehan. It's called John Paul Vann and America in Vietnam. It's incredibly well written. Neil Sheehan, for those who don't know, was the New York Times journalist who published the Pentagon Papers. For our purposes, it's most important because he was on the ground in Vietnam, I think like 66 onwards. literal institutional knowledge, an absolute titan of journalism in his time, probably one of the single best American journalists who's ever lived. And I cannot recommend his book enough, because it does the Caro thing where he picks a person, this guy, John Paul Vann, for people who don't know who he was. He was an American advisor in Vietnam from 1962 all the way up until his death in Vietnam. He died, plot twist, he died in Vietnam in a helicopter crash more than a decade later.
During the final offensive, right?
During the final offensive. That's why it's so, it's, you can't even make this shit up. It's like the guy who's one of the first like 10,000 American advisors on the ground, his entire career is in his whole adult life, basically at that time, is spent just on Vietnam policy. So you can actually tell the entire story of the war through his life, which is so rare. And I think it's a tragedy that most people don't know this. Most Americans would never be able to know this man's name. He's one of the most single consequential Americans in modern American history. I learned so much from this book, and I cannot recommend it enough.
Is it a long one on Audible? Does it work on Audible? Because sometimes it's not that length is the problem. Sometimes they don't work with
length. I'll tell you why it works. I'll tell you why it works. It's because it's at its core, and what he does best, it's a narrative biography. It's a narrative biography with the Vietnam War, which is told interwoven throughout John Paul Vann's life. So I can't recommend that enough. What else? I read this book, Sea Stories, by Bill McRaven. I'm not really sure why I finally got around to it, but I do recommend it. He was the Navy SEAL SOCOM commander. He was in charge of the Bin Laden raid. I know why. It's because I started thinking a lot about modern warfare after October 7th and about how and we should get into this at this point. This would be a fun discussion. My respect for the United States military has gone up by 100x watching the Israeli military campaign in Gaza. I cannot tell you how much like deep respect and admiration and just like how proud I am of the 2 million or so American forces who fought in the GWAT. The level of professionalism, training, they don't get nearly enough credit for the way that we conducted ourselves, the immense lengths that we went to avoid civilian casualties, the tactical evolution from the boot Marine all the way up into the commander level. So that was really interesting for me to read his book. Because I was trying to learn about standard operating procedures for like urban combat, fighting terrorists, lessons learned, and not in a counterinsurgency way, but also in like a killing terrorist way, and who some of the best leaders of that time were. Mm-hmm. What else?
Did you ever do McChrystal's bio? Because McChrystal's bio.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. 06, like 06, 07, kill teams. That's what that
there's
is.
There's some controversy around that. It's fine. So 18 Days in October by Uri Kaufman.
Dude, I did that too. That book was so good.
Fantastic. Man. I don't know why it took me so long to read it. Finally read it after October.
It's very new. It came out this August.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway.
Good timing.
Great timing. Because I was like, I need to know a lot about Yom Kippur. What else did I read? That was good. That would be... Oh, American Brands. H.W. Brands is like... I don't even know how to describe him. And I have no idea he cranks out this amount of books, but he does the best. He's like a Doris Kearns Goodwin type figure who's able to just pick a period, write a pretty good book, which is narratively interesting and that encompasses like an important period of American history. So this is his book on the Gilded Age, and not on the age specifically, but it's called The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900. And he tells it through the story of various titans, not in an annoying robber baron way, more in a narrative structure of the evolution of the U.S. economy into a full-blown industrial power. And then reread Restless Giant, which is a controversial book, but I would stand up for it. Have you read Restless Giant?
That's
the Oxford history.
45 to 74.
Watergate to Bush v. Gore. So, okay,
isn't the controversy, so this was, that came out too soon.
It came out too soon. It probably did come out too soon, but it's good.
Well, and what quick context for folks, like the Oxford histories are, we always mention them in these episodes because they're just so good. But for example, What Hath God Wrought, which is a great title. It's about like electricity. It's a great title. 1815 to 1848. That came out in the 21st century.
Right.
So, by contrast, the one that Sagar's talking about, you're writing that history 10 years after the period ends.
It's kind of like The Crown. Anyone watch The Crown? I'm not liking the William Kate
I left.
It's
I've
too
left.
new.
I'm not
It's too
watching this
recent.
season.
No, I would recommend the season overall, just to finish it out. It's our last one. That said, it's just a bit too on the nose when these people are like 40 years old. It doesn't work for me. And also because a lot of it played out in the tabloids. So those are all pretty good. Those are the last like couple months or so.
So before we get to, I want to follow up on your US-Israel army comments. Couple book notes. So A, love H.W. Brands. He actually has a new book about the founding era and fractious politics. Going to have him on the show early next year. Excited for that. So folks should check that out. But my recommendation for H.W. Brands is H.W. Brands, UT professor, shout out. But he takes popular history to the limit. Right. So he's able to do a book a year while also not making it feel vapid or silly. The books don't have like an annoying gimmick or something like that. So yeah, just really recommend all of his books. I especially enjoyed his book, The General versus the President, which is Truman versus MacArthur.
Arthur, yeah.
But in terms of books that I've just read, a random book that I thought was just like, so actually two things. So book that I was surprised I liked as much as I liked is I actually thought Romney, A Reckoning by McKay Coppins really, really worked. Super interesting book. Obviously people are going to kind of like disagree with Romney, they're going to disagree with some like takes that like McKay took it as, but just as a format type, I thought it was really, really interesting. Like Romney is very, very open with McKay. He gives him everything. It's like genuinely kind of accomplished. So I think if you're interested in political biographies, it took me a month to even purchase the book because I just assumed I wasn't going to like it. Very, very, very good, interesting book. So really recommend that. And then lastly, totally random one, but if you're particularly interested in the military stuff, there's this book by Paul Dickinson. It's called The Rise of the GI Army, 1940 to 1941. So typically when you read histories of the period, everyone just kind of does this quick thing where they're like, yeah, so like in 1940, the tanks were ice cream trucks because we didn't actually have any materials, and they're wearing the 1918 World War I doughboy hats, and the army was such a disaster. And then FDR gives a speech, and then Japan attacks, and then the army, it's tough in North Africa, but by 43, we've got it together. That's the typical way you're telling the history there. But The Rise of the GI Army is so cool because it just actually focuses on the first year or two of the initial Pearl Harbor attack draft and the struggles the military went through, all the people that had to be fired, all the people who got cashiered, just super, super, super interesting. So if you're interested in how kind of like change actually happens in a big institution, super, super fascinating. But yeah, Sagar, talk to me about, before we get to Q&A, talk to me about the military. And Israel. I think what happens when you have a conscript army.
Sorry, breaking up a bit, Marshall.
What I suspect is that if we get into the core of where your comments are going to lead, I bet a lot of this is probably going to center on the difference between a professional, all volunteer army and a conscripted army, set into these kind of circumstances. Because I just want to note one other thing here too, in case I got caught. Sagar, when you are talking about like our respect for the professionalism of the US Army and military as a whole, obviously England, what was her name? The woman who did the horrible stuff at Abu Ghraib.
Oh, I remember her name. It was
Jessica
Lindsay.
J Jessica England, Jessica
Jessica
London,
England.
something.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Jessica England. Abu Ghraib scandal is a super disaster. There are all sorts of like we're not alleging
Lindy
that there
England.
are not
Lindy.
Lydia, that
Yeah.
there are not like horrible incidents that occur, but I think if you just zoom out and look at the structure, the 99 times out of 100 aspect of this thing, that's probably what you're referring to. But kind of jump in, give me your take.
Actually, it's not just that, although that's a feature of it. It's from command on down. I have come to now understand the literally extraordinary lengths that, given the asymmetry of power that the US military commanders went to, that fully put tens of thousands of American soldiers on the line at the expense of trying to protect a civilian population. And I think setting the standard for a Western-style military in its engagement in an urban combat situation. I think Israel has not done basically any of that. So that's at a command level. I also would combine that with the baseline professionalism, even of our least trained troops. So a lot of people don't know this, but an immense amount of people who fought in Iraq were guys who joined the National Guard in like the 90s. And they thought, hey, what's the worst that's going to happen? I'm going to have to clean up after a Parkland hurricane. And then in 2005, Bush was like, guess what? You're going to Iraq for 15 months. Even those gentlemen, the incredible amount of professionalism and fight that they took to the enemy while trying to protect the civilian population, and that they displayed by not like desecrating mosques. And look, there's two parts here. There's also like the fight itself. And one of the things I was looking at, Marshall, I don't know if you saw this, but 20% of IDF acknowledged casualties, deaths, are friendly fire. 20%. That's insane. And I actually spoke to some people who were involved in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I asked them about it. And I was like, dude, am I crazy? And they're like, no, this is really high. This is Gulf War high. Actually, what happened to us in the Gulf War was developed all kinds of new standard operating procedures for the way that we operated, such that our friendly fire incident rate was like not even close. That's number one. Number two is the worst battle that's actually happened so far, the most deadly battle so far for the IDF, is it reads like a cartoonish clown. And
You're not diminishing.
Okay, here's what happened. Four like 19-year-olds like went into a house because they thought it was clear. They got blown up by an IED. And suddenly it became like a rescue mission where the battalion, like colonels and lieutenant colonels, were grabbing their rifles and were like, we got to go save these guys. There was no plan. There was no intelligence. There was no commander who took control of the scene. The colonel, lieutenant colonel, they all roll in there. Six more guys all get killed, including the battalion commander. And I was reading this. Again, I'm talking to these people who were literally engaging. They're like, this would never happen in the U.S. military. Number one, four guys are not wandering over by themselves without backup. Number one. Number two, there's a quick response force, like QRF or whatever it was called, that's in waiting. These plans, there's all these things are like go-to missions. And all of this happened in North Gaza, which is supposedly secure. And everyone I spoke to was like, this is just complete like reservist, like amateur hour in terms of the training. And it's sad because they all got killed. I mean, it was a bloodbath and it was an hours long fight with Hamas. More what I'm trying to point out here is I think it's really starting to hit home. The intense amount of professionalism that the U.S. military has, and my respect for U.S. commanders in the war who had let's be honest, they had way more firepower at their disposal than Israel ever did. They don't have any, they had basically no limiting principle in terms of tank munitions, JDAMs, bombs, any of these things. And let's also true, even under George W. Bush, 04, 05, they probably would have had the political support for that if they wanted it. And they never reached for it for a single second. So I'm very proud of the way that the U.S. military conducted itself, 04, 05, 04 onward in Iraq and Afghanistan. It is now really coming to home, like how an incredible amount of restraint that the average U.S. soldier, Marine, Airman, whatever, anyone who served in the military had at that time, considering just the sheer power differential.
Last topic before we get to rapid fire Q&A. So obviously everyone knows Sagar and I disagree on underlying Ukraine stuff, but I think we'll focus on something that you and I weirdly are going to, not weirdly, if you like listen between the lines of what we're saying, like totally agree on. I am incredibly frustrated by the political incompetence of the Zelensky visit to the U.S. The past week. And I think there's a couple things. I'll give my take, you give your take, then we'll go to Q&A. But here's my opening take here. Mostly because I'm plugged into Ukraine dove circles, I understand where Republicans are coming in on these things. I've just always been aware that there was going to be a limit on Ukraine aid from the Republican side. And I genuinely blame the Biden administration for not better owning and illustrating this following pretty straightforward narrative that would put us in a better place. So what the Biden administration should have done from the start has said, look, we are helping a small country defend itself against a nuclear armed superpower. That is a momentous, gargantuan task. We are doing that in the face of rising tensions in the Indo-Pacific. A Middle East will blow up at any second. Therefore, we will support Ukraine, but folks have to be aware the political environment could shift, the dynamics can change, the Europeans and the Ukrainians should not behave as if the United States has the permanent political capacity to give aid forever. Because once again, something Ukraine hawks like to point out is it's not as if the aid we're giving is unaffordable. It's not. Like, it's completely affordable. We can do these things. But fiscal affordability is something different than political feasibility. Just because we could give aid packages and send existing stock for the next 10 years doesn't mean we're going to do that. And I basically suspect that in all of these meetings with the Ukrainians and all these meetings with the Europeans, they just acted as if the question at hand in the American political system was, do we have the fiscal ability to do this? When what's actually happening, and you know this, this is probably our biggest disagreement, but it's still a dynamic, is there's a values and a purpose debate. This is actually where most of this stuff is centered around. Political will is not necessarily tied to the literal amount of fiscal dollars we could give. So given all that, the Biden administration gave the Europeans and the Ukrainians too much leeway in terms of how long our support would go on. And instead, they should have just said the following. What we're going to do here is preserve Ukraine's ability to exist as a functioning nation state. Ukraine has around 82% of its territory. I think especially when we all thought Ukraine was going to fall in 3 days, that's a pretty good freaking accomplishment. And like, I think a lot of that responsibility, aside from Ukrainian lives, goes to the fact that America backed the Ukrainians. However, that mission, the mission of preserving the Ukrainian statehood, is different than the mission of Ukraine takes back every single inch of its territory. It's different than Ukraine, does Ukraine join the EU or not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think very clearly what they could have done is said, hey, Europeans, everything that extends beyond, we'll do what we can, but realistically, anything that extends beyond Ukrainian statehood preservation, that's going to fall into your bucket. That's going to fall into Zelensky needed to make the case in European capitals to get that additional support, convincing the European capitals that Crimea is an achievable actual objective, instead of this weird in-between where clearly the administration is leaking to the Financial Times that they never quite believed they would reach Crimea, something I never truly believed. Yet at the same time, they're not just taking the leadership of it. So I'm just very, very, very frustrated by that. And we would have been much better off with Zelensky, because I still think there's maybe one more aid package left in the system. Like one more aid package, don't do the begging thing, don't further polarize the right against you, because that's actually what came out of this trip. This is just like a big rant, but just very, very frustrated. I get frustrated when you have a problem that could have been gamed out come summer. The second the offensive was not the D-Day level accomplishment that the Washington Post literally set up, we were walking into a political trap. I'm speaking as a Ukraine hawk here, and there should have been compensation and planning for that. So I was just like very, very frustrated. And I think it's frankly only because I frankly talked to people like you, but I think I was more realistically aware of these dynamics than everyone kind of thinking this is a hunky dory World War II movie where like we're going to end this with Zelensky giving a darkest hour Winston Churchill speech. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Seeing the collapse of the Churchill narrative has been amusing for me. I'm going to stick up for Biden. I think that Biden, between the lines and within his capabilities, okay, let's put it this way. Atlanticism is a religion in the foreign policy elite of this country. And this is actually a Russian term, so don't come at me and say, I know where I'm getting it. All that said, I actually think it's a useful way of thinking about it. Atlanticism, and this is like a fetishization of the U.S.-NATO relationship, and specifically to the Western European continent and Eastern European freedom, is the foreign policy paradigm which fits most neatly with the Cold War credentials, fights, comfort, and cultural knowledge of the vast majority of the people who work in American foreign policy, such that within that framework of Biden, the people around him, he did try, as all reporting has told us, him and Jake Sullivan privately, to tell Zelensky, hey, man, you need to be a little bit more grateful. I think this is where I'm not even sure within the political constraints that are real, the waters that Biden swims in, that it was possible for him to lay out anything that he said, Marshall, because I said all this for years and I have been called the literal Putin apologist. And I understand it's
well, but
tonal.
No.
I understand
this...
that. I understand this is tonal. I understand all of that. I do not think it is possible with the Ann Applebaums, Michael McFalls, and David Frums of the world to have conveyed literally any of that pre and post counteroffensive, especially because Zelensky himself made common cause with those individuals and made a very bad political strategic choice to believe everything that they said as what American politics and everything looked like. Now, I understand that the responsibility lays predominantly with President Biden, but given the way that the specific types of Americans who made Ukraine their first type of cause and literally basically moved to Ukraine or constantly in Ukraine, meeting with Zelensky, writing up his Atlantic profiles and all of this, I can't say I blame Zelensky for within the waters and swimming in that and thinking that this was the political reality. Here's the other thing, too. And this shows, too, about why America's complicated. In his mind, he's like the fucking Republican Senate Majority Leader, Mr. Turtle himself, tells me he supports Ukraine. So obviously Republicans support Ukraine, but he doesn't understand that it's like, well, Mitch McConnell's the least popular Republican in the Senate, and there's actually this burgeoning movement, and oh, actually Trumpism and Tuckerism and all these other stuff where they seem nascent, but they're actually not, and they're very much like channeled political objectives and things that are starting to make more sense to the American people. I kind of understand it. You know, from a foreign perspective, it's tough, you know, to look at that and to not just think, oh, yeah, box check. The Senate Majority Leader, Republican, supports it. So to a certain extent, I sympathize a little bit, especially because he has a war going on.
That's actually really fair. And I guess what, to a certain degree, this may be me making the error of being a person in the stadium seats thinking he could Monday morning quarterback better. I just was really, people need to read the Time magazine article that came out last month. I was just triggered to all ends when Ukrainians in Zelensky's circle said, quote, we were not prepped or ready for the U.S. foreign policy debate to go where it was going. Look, here's the thing. I guess it's just because I kind of study the Republican Party for a living. People dunked on J.D. Vance for saying Ukraine wasn't a priority for him at the start of the war. I disagree with that opinion. But I think clearly if you kind of take your personal feelings out of it, and I pride myself as a hawk to be able to do that, obviously in the long term, without resounding consistent military successes on the level of surviving those first 3 days and the first successful counteroffensive, the Republican position was going to trend in that direction. And the one last big thing before we do the Q&A, you know, my big lesson from this is, it was, and this is actually, I think, to your point, the real weakness of the Atlantic category. It was a disastrous decision once we left May 2022 to make Zelensky so much the stand-in for the Ukrainian cause in of itself. Because this is also a category where, frankly, this isn't even just like Zelensky's fault. It's a reality of our hyper-polarized political moment. Zelensky, the individual, has flaws, gets attacked, blows up at senators, does a bad Fox News hit where he's saying, don't prioritize things at home, prioritize Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, versus the cause of Ukraine, versus broader context, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think any other country, whether it's, or, you know, quasi-country like Taiwan, if there's ever a potential conflict with China, I think it would be a huge mistake for them to make this Churchill era and think the way to survive the political system is to so personalize the relationship between the two countries. Because I think from February to May, Zelensky should be the center of the relationship because he's the one who decides to stay past those 3 days when we told him to leave. Whether or not the actual quote was, I need more ammo, he did decide to stay in the face of calls to leave. in that period, he's the perfect stand-in for what was happening with Ukraine. But the second this transitioned away from surviving urban warfare in Kyiv and transitioned to this bigger geostrategic world-spanning conflict, he clearly didn't have the political chops or analytical ability or knowledge to actually do this. Because I was thinking about this, I guess I'll say something not nice about the Ukrainians, but like fair, like these Ukrainians, they wake up one day and all of a sudden they have to understand like Ohio swing state political dynamics.
Yeah.
This is, I struggle to imagine any nascent democracy or even plenty of existing democracies that would be ready to navigate the dynamics. So it was very, very tough. But that is just why I want to put pressure, not that this podcast matters in that context, there should be as much pressure on the White House as possible to beat it into people's heads. This is not Ronald Reagan's Republican Party. This is not George W. Bush's Republican Party. And especially, this is not Mitch McConnell's Republican Party. He does not hold the power that you want him to hold in this specific category.
Yeah, but that ship has sailed. It's over. I mean, and this is the other thing where you should be mad at Biden and Zelensky. They keep saying that anybody who is opposed to the aid is like pro-Putin. This is another thing. In an America and a Republican Party that survived Russiagate, can you think of a dumber thing to say?
Sorry, quick thing. You're making a very tactical statement. You're saying, look, like, yeah, neutral views aside, the last thing you should because I want people to understand what you're saying. Think about it this way, guys. The last thing you should do, if it's all, because there are a bunch of Republicans who are on the fence. This is legitimately true. The last thing you should do is walk into the Republican Senate caucus and trigger people's 2018, 2019 feelings. That is just what I mean by the political malpractice. So I want to just get into the Q&A section. Got a lot of good ones. To keep listening to the rest of this episode and the Q&A section between me and Sagar, or to submit your own Realignment Supercast AMA questions and comments, go to realignment.supercast.com to listen to the rest of the episode.